Here's some food for thought. The world suffers a lot, not because of the violence of bad people, but because of the silence of good people. Who said that? That was Napoleon Bonaparte. I guess words to live by back then and words to live by today. This is Nick Deolius. You're listening to the Far Middle Podcast, episode 39. Thanks for joining. And with episode 39, who are we going to dedicate number 39 to? Has to go to the one and only Dave Parker, the Cobra, back from the Pirates and Reds and A's fame in the 70s and 80s, and then I guess even into the 90s. So Dave Parker, from my perspective, one of the most egregious examples of somebody that should be in the Hall of Fame that is not over the history of baseball. And if you're my age, and which means you basically grew up, if you followed baseball, watching Dave Parker in his prime, you universally, you're going to love him. So anybody my age that, again, saw him when he was in his prime and doing what he did specifically for the Pirates, almost universal that you're going to love him and agree with that view that I've got that he needs to be in the Hall of Fame. If you're older than me, so if you're from an earlier generation, almost universal that you're going to dislike him. And the reason that many the older vintage, so to speak, dislike Dave Parker was because of a couple reasons. I mean, like everybody else, myself included, he was not perfect. So he had some issues when it came to his career and how he conducted himself. There was some issues with drug abuse. There were some issues with sort of contract disputes, and specifically when he was at Pittsburgh and the contract dispute that he got into. I think a lot of people in the city at the time, when it was going through some economic turmoil, didn't forgive him for his view of what he was worth. But, you know, he's looking after his own self-interest. I can't blame him for that. And there were some ugly incidents between the fans and Dave Parker during that time. I think a battery being thrown from the stands from the upper decks of Three River Stadium at the time is one that sits in my mind. And if you're younger than I am, unfortunately, the universal view there is that almost no one knows and understands, you know, the greatness of Dave Parker and the history that he brought with respect to his career. So I think your views on Dave Parker really boil down to what age demographic you fall in as a baseball fan. Me being in that first demographic where I got to see him doing his stuff at his best, no doubt in my mind, he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And probably the first thing that hits you with Dave Parker is just the physical specimen that he is or that he was. I think I told the story on a prior episode of the Far Middle when I was a kid. My dad took us down to a Pirate game, and we got there way before the first pitch during batting practice. And this was in the fall, sort of towards the end of baseball season, but at the start of at least exhibition season for football. And Three Rivers Stadium at the time was a multi-use stadium. So you had the Steelers playing with the Pirates. And during those overlap periods, you had, you know, that weird look of a football field with a dirt infield and stuff like that. But the Pirates were out there, and my dad said, "Hey, look over there. There's Mean Joe Green." And I looked, and I saw two guys talking to one another, and one was just towering over the other. So I figured that the bigger, larger individual was Mean Joe Green. It was a smaller individual. The bigger individual who Mean Joe Green was speaking to was Dave Parker, just an unbelievable physical specimen in terms of the physical attributes he brought to the game. And he was feared. The one thing about Parker, whether it was because of his physical attributes or just his arm or his hitting ability, I mean, the guy was feared. You could see that. And I think that's one of the signs of greatness when it comes to sports, right? Bob Gibson was feared. Dave Parker, pitchers had that fear in them that this is a force to be reckoned with. I remember a period of time when Parker broke his jaw, broke his jaw during a game, during one game. And then he ended up, when he came back, he wore a face mask, like a football face mask, on his batting helmet for a while his jaw fully healed. And if you think he was sort of intimidating without something like a face mask on a batting helmet, it made him even more so with that. And you can check out some of those photos on the internet if you want to see what Dave Parker looked like wearing a face mask when he was batting, when he had that broken jaw. And, you know, the sort of accolades that followed him through his career, I think they sort of speak for themselves. He was the National League MVP in 78, I believe, top three in MVP voting three other years. So, you know, just looking at the most valuable player for the National League, basically four times he was in the top three, one of the four, he actually earned the top spot. And then, of course, one of his key moments was in 1979, the All-Star Game, when All-Star Games used to be really awesome. I mean, All-Star Games to me were the funnest of all, the most fun of all the baseball games in the season, especially in the 70s. But in 79, up in Seattle in the Kingdome, Dave Parker just put on a clinic. And really, what people most remember is what he did in the field. The one I think is really telling. There was a pop-up, Parker's in right. This is during the 79 All-Star Game. And there was some confusion in that sort of shallow right field area along the foul line where you had Dave Parker as the right fielder. Joe Morgan at the time was the second baseman. Jim Rice pops the ball up when he was with the Red Sox for the American League, and it drops. Okay, so the fly ball falls to the ground because Morgan and Parker weren't able to communicate. Jim Rice, he's paying attention to all this, so he's rounding the bases. He wants to stretch this from a double into a triple. So he's running for third. Parker takes in the ball there after it had this massive bounce off of the Seattle Kingdome floor, which was basically concrete. They called it AstroTurf, but it was concrete. Must have, you know, bounced, I don't know how many dozens of feet into the air. He fields it off the bounce and just guns down Jim Rice. Ron Say, by the way, the Dodgers, was the one that tagged out Jim Rice. And the other one is what everybody is talking about. I thought the first one that I just gave you was the most telling because, I mean, you have Jim Rice, Joe Morgan, Dave Parker, and just the bounce and everything else made it pretty cool. But the other one, the other throw that Parker performed there and pulled off in the 79 All-Star Game is the one everybody talks about. That's where Craig Nettles was up to bat for the Yankees. He hits a single to right. You know, Parker grabs it, takes it in, and he guns down Brian Downing, who was tagged out by Gary Carter at home. Again, some interesting names, right? 70s All-Star Baseball. You had Reggie Jackson when that play occurred, who was a runner on first. Pete Rose was the first baseman. I think Pete Rose might have been with the Phillies at the time. I'm not sure about that. Hey, baseball in the 1970s, I said it before, I'll say it again, it was the greatest era. And then in 1979, right, the Pirates win the World Series. During that playoff run, Parker did awesome. He was a hitting machine. So, yeah, Dave Parker could be polarizing, and Dave Parker had issues. But again, no one's perfect, and the Hall of Fame should be about on-the-field performance. We could do, I guess, an entire episode on players who aren't in the Hall of Fame due to arbitrary and inconsistent standards. You know, hello, Pete Rose. But maybe we'll save that for another time. Dave Parker deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. If Ted Simmons is in the Hall of Fame, which he is, then Dave Parker should be in the Hall of Fame as well. Really no comparison between the two. Parker, for a period of time, was undoubtedly one of the top three players in all of baseball. So for that alone, let's get him in the Hall. Now, I didn't mean to turn this into a dissertation on Dave Parker, the case for him. So let's move on to some of these other dots that we want to connect in episode 39. Look, the Cobra, he didn't play it safe, right, when he was trying to gun down runners in that 79 All-Star game. And he reaped the rewards because he took on those risks and basically tried to be the best that he could be in the field. That, unfortunately, is not the case today in government and service areas that are provided by government, right? Areas where government in one shape or form is providing a service, like education, like our public schools, our public universities. I came across a new term that I'm seeing more and more of out there, and I think it's code oftentimes. So the term is out of an abundance of caution, right? We're hearing that more and more, basically a plea for public safety or in the interest of public safety. That, unfortunately, is becoming code for taking a day off or glossing over maybe some staffing issues or accountability issues when it comes to our public schools, whether it's K through 12, whether it's, again, universities or colleges. And what I mean by that is we're sitting here in February, and about a week ago, we had an event coming, a weather event, where there was going to be rain basically transitioning to sleet, then to ice, then to snow. So always, you know, tricky with the weather, of course, in Western Pennsylvania in February. And when that occurs, you want to be careful with respect to what you're doing. But basically, the threat of rain on the first day that this front was moving through was enough to cancel effectively all in-person learning across Western Pennsylvania. I'm talking about kindergartens, morning or afternoon. I'm talking about grade schools, high schools, colleges and universities, everybody. Didn't just cancel the Thursday when the rain was occurring, but then ultimately once late Thursday night or early Friday morning when the actual snow showed up, it of course canceled everything again for the Friday. And it sort of brings to mind the question of how soft have we become, or how soft have certain sectors of our economy and certain professions or certain institutions become. And I want to think through this objectively. What I keep coming back to when I do that in my mind is that COVID has provided, and pandemic, along with the shutdowns that went with it, those things have provided or created perhaps a couple of bad habits when it comes to administrative staffs with our educational facilities, some of the public unions that hold sway across our educational institutions, and then the academics themselves. One thing I think the COVID pandemic shutdown had reinforced in a bad way is that with the shutdown accompanying pandemic, you had, of course, remote learning for what it is worth. And I really question at times how effective it actually is. So this idea of remote learning, or at least the mirage of it, became instituted. And then we established that we have the technology, right? To use that quote from the $6 million man, we have the technology. So now we can do remote learning, and there is such a thing. Thus, why not use the technology if you've got it? So a snow day today, or a rain day, in the instance of the example I just used about a week ago, you're not losing a day because you have this mirage of remote learning where at least we can all pretend that the students will continue to learn despite not being in school that day. Then you also have shutdowns that created psychologically, I'll call it, a new normal for parents and for students, so that when you finally got back to in-person instruction, but albeit at a reduced attendance rate because of rainouts or snow days, that still looks great. That still looks superior relative to the lens of the shutdown. So we're going from a period where there was no in-person education every single day for entire semesters or calendar years of school calendar years. And we're just happy we're back. And the fact that we're happy that we're back, if you've got a week where you have a rain day on Thursday and a snow day on Friday, well, heck, at least we had 3 days of in-person learning. That's better than nothing. So we've been sort of conditioned to a new normal, which I think sets expectations very low. And when you've got low expectations, right, you can expect poor outcomes in most instances. And then, right, COVID pandemic, the shutdown, it created cover for those taglines that you don't want to mess with or debate because you'll be labeled something along the lines of a Cro-Magnon. So that tagline, out of an abundance of caution, that's sort of like your bulletproof vest. You throw that tagline and wave that banner around, nobody can challenge you, because then if you do challenge them, you're simple-minded, you're backward-thinking, and you're not an enlightened person. So it's much like following the science, right? How often do we see that now? And so instead of maybe these taglines of out of an abundance of caution, maybe the tagline that we should be employing more is out of the interests of student proficiency. And if we are really looking at things from the perspective of student proficiency in math and science and reading and writing, we should have as much in-person learning as we possibly can. And something like a rainstorm shouldn't be stopping us from holding in-person learning. And why is this whole issue so special? Why is it unique to public K-12 education and colleges and universities, academia? Because if you looked around during all the rain on that Thursday and all the snow on that Friday, you saw all kinds of things going on. You saw Amazon was still delivering their products. You saw FedEx and UPS trucks still doing what they do. Energy companies kept running, so the lights turned on and the homes were heated. Restaurants, at least the ones that were allowed to open, right, they remained open and served their customers. Truckers were driving. All the other areas of the economy and jobs and professions kept going. Why were schools in the educational system different? I think the root cause is because our education system has become, unfortunately, an entrenched enterprise where accountability is far down the list of priorities. And student proficiency, those results don't matter nearly as much as they used to or as they should. And as we discussed many times on many prior episodes of The Far Middle, the sooner that changes, the better for everybody. Now, this issue of what was going on with our schools and maybe how accountability has taken a backseat to the entrenched interests across our educational system got me thinking on the topic of all things of federal paid holidays and federal holidays. Right now, I don't know if you know this or not, I didn't until I did some research, there are 11 paid federal holidays. And some of them are the obvious ones like Christmas and Thanksgiving, and then you've got a host of others. And there's a proposal in Congress right now to create a 12th paid federal holiday, which would be the Lunar New Year, right? So this would be the New Year celebration for our Asian friends and neighbors, whether they're Chinese or Korean or Vietnamese that celebrate the Lunar New Year. Couple of thoughts here. One, when I first saw this, the more we celebrate, the better, right? The more inclusive we can be, the more excuses we've got to be inclusive, learn something about what our neighbors are all about or their history. That's all good stuff. Juneteenth, we saw it with that. That was awesome. Look forward to it every year moving forward. And if the Lunar New Year gives us an opportunity to do that with Asian Americans and the Asian culture and the different subcultures within it, awesome. All for it. Second thought that I sort of came upon after contemplating this is that there is a difference, and we tend to not differentiate this, but there is a difference between recognizing a holiday and celebrating a holiday and using that as an opportunity to improve inclusiveness versus creating a paid-off holiday for federal workers. There's a difference between those two. And in the end, government and government workers are there to serve. They're there to serve the citizen, or they're there to serve the taxpayer. Let's focus and keep the attention laser-focused on improving service to those individual citizens and to those taxpayers. So when it comes to government, considering things like new holidays and celebrating those holidays and paid holidays and the whole sort of group of considerations that go into it, let's have government celebrate more. That would be good. Let's have government, right, help improve inclusiveness. That's good. Let's have government focus on how they can spend less. That's our money. Let's have government focus on how they can serve better. They're, you know, we're investing our taxes into those enterprises to get a rate of return in a form of good service. And I think, right, looking at celebrating more, being more inclusive, I think with respect to spending less, being more tight with our dollars so that we get more bang for the buck, and I think better service, I think all three of those things, they are not mutually exclusive. I think there's a way to achieve all three. And there's many industries and entities in the private space and in free market that know how to do that on a very consistent basis. Let's copy and paste some of those learnings from them onto government. Now, a couple of items or dots prior, we talked about that sort of tagline of over or out of an abundance of caution, right? How that is being conveniently applied or misapplied when it comes to government or government-run entities. Got me to thinking about another often used tagline that everybody says and speaks, but very few people think through on what it actually means, which is sustainable. And here I'm talking about the context of business models and businesses. What is a sustainable business? What makes for a sustainable business model? Lots of talk these days about the social purpose of a business, what it is and what it is not, about the sustainability of a business, what that means, what it doesn't. So what are the elements of a sustainable business model? This is something that I've been talking about quite a bit over the course of basically 2021, and I suspect I'm going to talk just as much about it over the course of 22 when I'm out there just engaging and interacting with entities and individuals. So thinking of it in the context of the businesses that I've been associated with and I'm used to, when I think of a sustainable business model, I think of the ability to do a couple of things sequentially, time in and time out, over the course of a longer period of time. And it all starts with basically the ability to operate, conduct yourself safely and compliantly when it comes to the rules and regulations that are out there with respect to your activity. So you got to be safe. You have to be compliant. Those are sort of the prerequisite starting points. If you can operate efficiently in a safe and compliant manner, then that's going to create some inherent advantages that you enjoy. So if you're a manufacturer, if you're in the energy industry, that's going to mean things like being the low-cost producer. That's going to mean that you're able to de-risk the execution plan that you lay out for a year or for a five-year period or for a decade. And if you're able to do those things, then those low costs and those inherent advantages that you bring to bear and the de-risking of your operating plan, when you start delivering on the operating plan, you generate free cash flow. And free cash flow is, again, one of those metrics that you think is very straightforward and you can easily calculate it, but you'd be surprised at how many businesses out there take liberties when it comes to defining their free cash flow. Free cash flow is a very simple calculation. Every dollar coming into the business minus every dollar that you spend in the business. Doesn't matter how it's coming in, doesn't matter what you're spending it on. Everything in minus everything out equals free cash flow. And if you have positive free cash flow, that means you had more money coming in than you had to go out. That's a good thing. So the ability to generate or manufacture free cash flow, that's crucial, and that's the crucial next step. You then have that free cash flow to allocate. Now, how are you going to invest that free cash flow? Are you going to make your bets and your investments in the right places and at the right time? You basically invest your free cash flow across a range of different crucial avenues. One, you always want to invest first and foremost in your team, on your people, on your employees, your coworkers. And a lot of that is incentive-based, right? So if you can deliver the results under the conditions that that everybody agreed upon, you get rewarded, you get motivated and incentivized to do so. So you invest in your people, you invest in your coworkers, you invest in your team. Then you invest in the communities and the regions that you operate within. So the business that I work for, we've been in our region for over 155 years. It means a lot to us. We're always looking for those partnerships and those really tangible and impactful and local opportunities to make a difference and to basically grow the broader right group of interested parties that we deal with in a region year in and year out. And then after investing in your team and investing in your community, right, you want to look at your asset base. What can we reinvest in with equipment, with activity, right, whatever the case might be, to develop rate of return projects that create value. And then after that, with the free cash flow that's left after you've invested in your people, after you've invested in your region that you live in, after you've invested in your asset base that you're looking over and trying to optimize, well, now you've got two remaining decisions to make with the remaining free cash flow. Do I pay down debt? And it's always a good idea for a business, I believe, to consistently pay down some level of debt. It doesn't always need to be a massive amount of debt every quarter or every 6 months or every year. But you do want to see a business, right? If it's truly going to be sustainable, it should be always continually strengthening its balance sheet. It should always be continually improving its liquidity. And that comes in the form of paying down debt. So paying down debt creates all kinds of positives. There's some of them that are more tangible and visible and obvious, but some of them are also quite significant, but quite intangible. It's the optionality, I'll call it, of having financial flexibility so that when opportunities present themselves, if nothing else, or when downturns happen that you can't foresee coming, you're in a much better position, not just to navigate through them, but ultimately to capitalize on them, take advantage of them. And then last but not least, after all those other sort of requirements and needs for free cash flow allocation are met, now you've got the ability, if you've got sufficient free cash flow and you're truly sustainable, to return that free cash flow, a portion of it, to your owners, to your shareholders in the case of a public company. And that could be done through dividends. That can also be done through buying your own shares in and leaving a bigger piece of the pie, so to speak, for the remaining shareholders and owners. And by the way, shareholders and owners aren't all billionaires or multimillionaires. They can be pension funds that are looking for returns to be able to pay millions of retirees, right? They can be mom and pop investors. They can be mutual funds that people have invested in with respect to their 401ks. So there's many different investors, basically, that you're looking to serve under this sustainable business model. So it's a pretty simple one, right? And it is quite sequential. You start with safety and compliance. You develop some operating advantages that are sustainable over time. Those operating advantages create free cash flow. And then you start methodically allocating that free cash flow across people, community, your capital or asset-based projects, debt reduction, return to shareholders. That is truly a sustainable business model that is very measurable across every single one of those steps with tangible metrics. And that's the type of business model that we look towards, at least with respect to my experience, that I think really puts you in a position not just to achieve, but to win the day on behalf of your ownership and what your objectives are, versus being sort of subjected to the whims and the twists of the turns of fate. So I wanted to connect that dot when we had a chance in episode 39. People, they always ask me, what do you really think a sustainable business model is, Nick? And I thought that was an opportunity to share my views on what sustainable business models equate to. Now, on the subject of business, how about those fossil fuel companies? We talked about the unintended consequences of ESG investing, of environmental social governance investing, if you don't do it the right way. We talked about that on the Far Middle podcast. We talk about that in my upcoming book, Precipice, where you basically are looking to just ideologically, I'll call it, shun or starve capital flows to entities like oil or natural gas producers, domestic natural gas or domestic oil producers. And when you do that, you think maybe the ideologically minded individual thinks that they're basically shutting down those businesses or harming those businesses. But in reality, there is the unintended consequence where those businesses actually become more profitable. And why do they become more profitable? Well, they have to be more disciplined because capital becomes scarcer. So that's one reason. But the other reason is that whenever you are going to unilaterally or artificially impede capital flows to commodities or to energy, that means less supply. Less supply coupled with a reality, a stark reality, that demand for natural gas or the demand for oil globally is going to continue to rise. People still rely on this day and will so well into the far distant future on the carbon atom and the methane molecule, right? So demand's growing inevitably because people have a clamoring for energy. That equates the quality of life. To be anti-carbon is to be anti-human. So demand's growing. Supply has been artificially reduced because of this siphoning of capital. What happens? That means higher prices, and then higher prices for these types of energy companies means more profitability. So guess what's happening? If you look at 2022 so far, early in the year, S&P Energy up 20%+ for the year. S&P overall, by the way, is down 5% for the year. So the S&P indices, S&P 500 is down, but the energy subpiece of the S&P 500 is up big time. Exxon, remember Exxon, that fossil fuel company, up 80% in 1 year's time. Chevron is up over 50%. So that's the scoreboard. What's funny is actually when you listen to the talking points in the transcripts of all these companies when they report their earnings, so you're hearing like, what are the reasons for this great performance and these profits and cash flows and high share prices? Well, the management teams are touting how well they manage COVID and how efficient they've become, what good jobs of capital allocation they've achieved, you know, their workforce, which is super dedicated, et cetera. And I'm sure all of those things are true. I'm not questioning those. But the biggest driver and the biggest reality is that bad government policy basically jacked up prices of the product. That's been the biggest driver. So government didn't allow, basically, when you think through this, it didn't allow the industry of natural gas or oil to be a victim of its own success, right? We talked about how innovation in energy is no different. We've seen it in technology. We're seeing it in social media. You see it in energy with natural gas and shale development. Innovation increases supply, reduces cost. That reduces, right, the pricing of those products because it becomes more abundant for the users of the products, and demand takes a long time to develop and grow to catch up with the more abundant supply. Government didn't allow the industry to be a victim of its own success. And thus, there's a corollary to that. If you didn't allow that to happen, that meant that you didn't allow prices to drop, and this didn't allow the middle class and the consumer to reap the reward of the energy revolution. Shame on government for its ill-advised policies when it comes to energy, and now these unintended consequences, it's rearing its head in very obvious fashion. And speaking of the markets, the stock markets and the S&P 500, I still remain hyper, hyper worried. I'm stressed beyond belief with the state of the markets. I'm just waiting any day to wake up and read about a correction that I believe is inevitable to happen. Another metric, I've given you some metrics in the past that sort of are blaring or blinking red on extreme valuations of the S&P 500 and of the overall stock market or equity markets. I found yet another one to be worried about. This one is the S&P 500, and it's the ratio of insiders. So these are basically executives that work for the S&P 500 companies. It's a ratio of insider sellers to buyers. So obviously, the higher the ratio of sellers to buyers on the inside are, the more it indicates that the people who are in the know, right, the people that work for these actual companies, are looking at the value, the stock price of the company itself versus the implied value of the business and thinking, hey, this thing is overvalued in terms of share price. I'm going to sell my shares because it's a great price. It's more than a fair price. It's an overvalued price. Well, if you look at that ratio of insider sellers to buyers, it's pushing a ratio of 20 right now for the S&P 500. And that number of, I think it's 19.3, just under 20, that's the highest that it's been for the data set that I saw. So that's the highest. My data set went back to the early 2000s, 2003, 2004. Another metric, like if we needed another one, right? We've got another metric that gives us great concern when it comes to the current valuation levels of things like the S&P 500. So again, investor beware. And I started with a quote from Napoleon on this episode, and I talked a little bit about sustainability in the context of business models, right? So I'm going to wrap this episode 39 of the Far Middle Podcast with another quote, and it's a quote that deals with environmentalism and sustainability. It's a quote from the great Michael Crichton, one of my favorite all-time authors. Just, you know, a slew of great books, futuristic type books, technology-based books, taken from us. Michael Crichton was all too young. I wish he was still around writing great books, but we lost him, obviously. But he had he had some great quotes on and views and speeches on scientific consensus, the flaw of scientific consensus, and climate change, and just a really insightful individual when it came to political science versus actual science in the context of environmentalism. But he had a quote about something along the environmental movement that was talking about sustainability that I thought you would enjoy, and I'll wrap this episode with his quote. He said, quote, "There's an initial Eden, a paradise, a state of grace and unity with nature. There's a fall from grace into a state of pollution as a result of eating from the tree of knowledge. And as a result of our actions, there is a judgment day coming for all of us. We're all energy sinners, doomed to die unless we seek salvation, which is now called sustainability. Sustainability is salvation in the church of the environment. Just as organic food is its communion, that pesticide-free wafer that the right people with the right beliefs imbibe." Well said, Michael Crichton. Everybody, enjoy your week. Talk to you soon.